North Idaho is home to beautiful mountains and scenic lakes, small-town tranquility, civil freedom, and the faithful Lutheran parish of Blessed Sacrament Lutheran Church, located in Hayden, Idaho, near Coeur d'Alene. Blessed Sacrament Lutheran Church is a proud sponsor of A Brief History of Power. If you like what you hear on Brief History, then you will love Blessed Sacrament, where the Lord's Word is faithfully preached and Christ's body and blood are administered at every divine service. Whether you are visiting Idaho or considering moving to Idaho, wouldn't it be nice? Please join the saints of Blessed Sacrament Lutheran Church for the Mass and Augsburg Academy Bible Study. Directions, service times, and much more information about this confessional liturgical parish may be found at blessedsacramentlutheranchurch.com. Blessed Sacrament Lutheran Church, Historic Christian Orthodoxy, the Evangelical Lutheran Faith, in the beautiful Inland Northwest. At 7,123 feet, you can find mountains soaring above you and rivers running swiftly in the valley below you. Natural beauty of every kind. But our God is richer in his gifts than this. At 7,123 feet in Pagosa Springs, Colorado, you can also find God's Word preached purely and His sacraments given out for your salvation at Our Savior Lutheran Church and School. Located off US 160, just west of downtown Pagosa, Our Savior offers your children a wonderful place to learn of Christ and His wisdom week in and week out, and offers you the medicine of immortality Sunday in and Sunday out. Our Savior Lutheran School provides a Christ-focused classical education that enriches the child's soul with the best that has been thought and said to the glory of God. Whether you visit while vacationing or hunting in the beauty of the area, or whether you would like to join a group of faithful Lutheran Christians, Our Savior Pagosa Springs has what you're looking for. Divine service with Holy Communion is each Sunday at 9 a.m., and Bible class follows at 10:30. At more than a mile high, you will find Christ in all His glory in the midst of His people at Our Savior Lutheran Church and School, a proud sponsor of A Brief History of Power. Find out more at oslcpagosa.org.
We're going to go ahead and get our presentation started. Hopefully our tech is working. It's my pleasure to introduce our guest speaker this morning and this afternoon. Born in the great state of Pennsylvania, he now serves as a professor at CTSFW, that's Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne. He does lots of speaking. He's been on Issues Etc., and he was the keynote speaker at the CCLE conference last summer. That's the, and I always get the two C's mixed up, Consortium for Classical Lutheran Education. He is the co-host of A Brief History of Power, a weekly podcast. This isn't necessarily their tagline, so you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, that tries to make sense of the present using the past. Very good podcast, and one of the reasons why I wanted to bring Dr. Kuntz out to Hamel. He had, it was like 4-hour-long episodes on education. And in addition to just speaking about lots of other things that could help us not only as teachers, but as people of God, moving forward in this kind of weird world. So with that introduction, I'd like to and ask you to help me to give a warm welcome to our speaker, the Reverend Dr. Adam Kuntz.
Thanks for having me, guys. What we're going to do for about the next hour is go over some historical stuff that'll give us a little bit of a setting for what we're talking about today. We'll also talk about, and these are kind of my headings for this hour, and then the others in, later on this morning and then in the afternoon. This hour we're going to be talking about love as both ground and motive for Lutheran schools. Then we'll talk about discipline. We're going to give that word maybe a fuller meaning than it often has. In the afternoon, we'll kind of wind down or ease off some of the headier things we're talking about this morning. I'm going to ask more of your attention this morning. In the afternoon, you know this, as you know, students get tired or antsy, we'll talk about the scope of education. what it was in the early Missouri Synod and what it is for us now, especially in classical schools. And then finally, methods. And this is just going to be sort of interesting, and we'll open up. I know we have time for Q&A after that, but we'll open up for Q&A really at any point throughout the day. I don't mind if you interrupt me. This isn't a big performance by myself or something. So go ahead and raise your hand at any point. But in the afternoon, as we talk about methods, we'll open up for discussion because the comparison of some of the methods that were historically used with what we do and where they are the same, why they might have different purposes now than they did then, all of that I think will be interesting to you. So we're going to start with kind of more theoretical things and work into more practical things in the afternoon. For about the next hour, I want to talk about love as ground and motive, but I want to start by explaining where I'm getting some of this, not all of it. So this is not just a purely historical presentation about the way things used to be or used to be done. But some of what I'm getting, and a lot of it, especially in the afternoon, are from two men, one of whom is kind of the father of Lutheran education in the Missouri Synod, and one of whom is very influential sort of later on. Okay. The first of those is a guy named J.C.W. Lindemann. He dies in the mid-1870s, so that's pretty early in the whole scheme of things. He doesn't make it to the 30th anniversary of the Missouri Synod, right? So 1876, if I remember correctly. In 1872, he writes a book called Evangelical Lutheran School Praxis, right? Praxis. So basically, it's a manual for how to be a teacher, how to run a school, including mundane details, when you should let them outside, things like that. That's all in there, but also a lot of theological points, and that's what we'll be talking about, especially in this hour, Evangelical Lutheran School Praxis. That seems to be the textbook at both what is then the Addison Teachers Seminary in Addison, Illinois, later to be Concordia River Forest, okay, and now Concordia, Chicago, as well as by the time it's founded in the 1890s at the Teachers College in Seward, Nebraska, now Concordia University, Nebraska. He's the textbook. It's in German. It's never made it into any other language, right, including English. So this doesn't get translated. And that's gonna be significant because like a lot of other things, especially in our own churches, just our church's specific heritage, when things get locked into what are now to us foreign languages, they also just get forgotten, dropped. Almost more than forgotten if I never knew it existed, right? To forget my keys at home is to mean that I once had them and I knew that they were there and what they do. We don't even know that he's there, right? This got stuffed into, you know, the insulation by a previous occupant of the house, and we don't even know that it's there, okay? So that's Lindemann. His work, this school praxis book, is really extensive. So it covers both what's going to be called pedagogy in English, so German is very different from English in that it's just got a smaller vocabulary, so the words are more obviously related to each other. And so if I had to turn it into English, that it's going to be awkward but makes sense. He talks about this as raising up. So there's a whole section on raising up. They don't use this word pedagogy. They don't have fancy words. It's raising up. How do we raise up in a school? But in addition to that, there's what kind of curricula are we going to have? And that's kind of spelled out along with lists of books. Who is the teacher? How do we think about the teacher's call? Okay, both specifically in the church, but also maybe more generally, you know, what do you get up in the morning and think that you're doing in the school? That's all in there. A much more limited book that is, however, somehow supposed to replace that book is from 1930 by a guy named E.W.A. Keeler, K-O-E-H-L-E-R. He had, maybe that name is familiar to you, he wrote a book called Summary of Christian Doctrine that is sometimes used and I think was intended for kind of higher levels of Lutheran school. in order to give a basic knowledge of Christian theology to maybe like high school students or even college students. He also wrote an explanation to the Small Catechism that still, I believe the print shop at Fort Wayne still prints that book. So he wrote a variety of things. He also, like Lindemann, taught at what is now Concordia University Chicago, right? So in 1930, he writes a book called Christian Pedagogy. He says, this is supposed to replace, he mentions Lindemann by name, this is supposed to replace Lindemann, but the thing is, not only is it a lot smaller and kind of a different book for reasons that are understandable and we can discuss later, it really just covers the specific to the discussion of education, pedagogical questions, such as, what are children? Like, what am I dealing with when I'm dealing with a child, right? Things that if you were in a modern educational college would get filed under maybe child development or child psychology or something. And some of it is very traditional, recognizable from Lindemann, but it doesn't really tell you what is a Lutheran school for, what is a Lutheran teacher, why do we have Lutheran schools, how do we run them? There's no list of curricula, such as you find in Lindemann. That's because there are all these other books, none of which we really have anymore, okay? So one thing to notice is that over time, our thinking about what we're doing in a Lutheran school gets really fragmented. And that's because of just kind of a general historical thing, and this will set us up for the discussion of love, okay? In Lindemann's time, in the 1800s, still in the 19th century, your average Lutheran school is kind of an unusual place in the sense that it's generally taught by a man. It's pretty unusual in American education, even in the 19th century, right? Think about the descriptions of schools maybe in like Little House on the Prairie, right? That school is usually taught by a woman. Teaching is already generally a female profession, okay, even in the 19th century. Lutheran schools are different, okay? There are three different institutions where a teacher could be trained in the Missouri Synod by the end of the 19th century. At the beginning, they get trained at the Fort Wayne Seminary, which is still in Fort Wayne when it gets started, and they're trained right alongside pastors. Then there's Addison, later River Forest, now Chicago, and then eventually there's Seward, Nebraska. At each of those places, they get trained, and they're going to get a call and go out, and they're probably going to be, and you have pictures right here of these men. There's generally one. There's one pastor and one teacher, and that actually means you're a pretty big church, okay, that the teacher is somebody different than the pastor, because in roughly half of Missouri Synod schools, the teacher and the pastor are the same person, and not at St. Louis, but at first Fort Wayne and then later Springfield Seminary, they were all trained to do things like teach science because they just assumed that their graduates would be teaching. So it's kind of the Missouri Synod is very unusual in this way, in teaching being a mainly male profession. And that's conveyed by a variety of things. The teacher has a call. The teacher is called by Lindemann a servant of the word. That's a title pastors also have. And he also has a title. He's called teacher. He's not called Mr. or she is not called Miss or Mrs. It's teacher, last name, just like pastor, last name. So it's kind of an unusual, Missouri Synod's unusual educationally in that. By Kaler's time, 1930s, this is no longer true. Okay. The Missouri Synod still has vastly more men teaching than even the Roman Catholic Church, certainly than in public schools. And just this is kind of a side note. When I think of American public schools historically, I kind of think of them as non-denominational Protestant schools. If you look at what they actually do religiously, historically, and I grew up in a small town, small enough that we still did things like this, like we had prayers and we had this thing called church school that we would walk across the street to, and we would like learn the Ten. So I didn't grow up in church, but we learned the Ten Commandments. We learned the books of the Bible. We learned all this stuff, and nobody objected to this. And it was functionally non-denominational Protestant, right? That's what your average public, and go, you know, again, go look at Little House on the Prairie for a reflection of this, right? What are they doing? They read the Bible. They don't say you should baptize babies or not baptize babies. There's no particular catechism involved. They read the Bible. They pray. Maybe they pray the Lord's Prayer. maybe they learned the Protestant version of the Ten Commandments. It's kind of a non-denominational Protestant school. That's what public schools are, I'm saying, functionally, historically in America. So there's that. There's Catholic schools. Catholic schools are largely taught by nuns who basically are just fed and clothed, and that's about it. But that's how they staff most of these schools. Lutheran schools are still pretty unusual, even down to the 1930s. But Kaler is not specific about who's teaching, whether this person does or doesn't have a divine call or a certificate of vocation. A lot of that stuff is just, and I'm just speaking historically at this point, he just kind of leaves up for determination. Okay. In addition to his book, there's a bunch of other small books called the Concordia Teachers Library, which you probably have somewhere around here if you dig. And if you don't, I'm sorry you got rid of them at some point, because they're very interesting books, but they're old now, no longer available. A lot of the volumes are written by a man named P.E. Kretzmann, who's very important at this point for teaching education. He teaches at the St. Louis Seminary eventually. He's kind of suspicious for having a doctorate at that time. That's that because it's from outside the synod. So, you know, the past is not always golden. You know, they were just suspicious because it wasn't us. So he had a doctorate in education, so he's pretty influential. The reason I set all this up is to give you a little bit of a sense of historical perspective, but also to give you a sense that this is an ongoing conversation in which your school here is an enduring historical example of these people who cared enough to educate their own children in ways distinctive, both in the 1870s and in the 1930s and in the 2020s. So there's a sense in which I have no need to teach you, or I can't even teach you anything today, because your school here specifically has continued these things over time. Now, at a certain point, you can see over there in the historical display to my right, you can see the title change from teacher last name to Mr. last name. And that does mark certain things, okay? Mark some of these changes I just mentioned. But you've had this the whole time, right? And so what we're saying is, just to begin, is that you are inheritors of something, but also have a responsibility to pass it on. You're heirs of something, but you're also those who will bequeath something to your children and grandchildren, the children and grandchildren of the parish, right? You're in a very long line. And it's that sense of continuity that I want to stress just to start today. Because that means that not only can the past probably tell us something, but it means this too, not just that we have inherited something from the past, but that what we can see witness to in the past is love. Because you have to ask yourself, why would these people go to these lengths, produce all their own books? Okay, because generally the book recommendations, when and where they exist, are either, especially in the German language, they're either printed in St. Louis, or they have to ship them from Germany to get them here. Okay, so you can't just walk into any. They're actually not okay with stuff that people like myself now love and are nostalgic for, like McGuffey's readers. They don't like McGuffey's readers. Okay, They have all their own books, okay? And they either print them at their own cost or they ship them here. And some of this is, you know, understandable, and some of it is very culturally foreign to us. But what it does evidence is that they desire the children to know Jesus Christ. They desire the children to know how to be useful citizens in this country. Most of all, they really desire the children to obtain heaven. There's a couple of things that are going to follow from that that you do find in continuity really throughout the history of our synod's discussion of education, close to the present time. And most of this I'm getting out of Lindemann, because other reading that I've done either echoes these things or assumes these things. And assuming is generally bad. One of the things that's assumed is that worship is actually central to the Lutheran school. And that means that the Lutheran school is, first of all, the place where both the teacher and the child will know the love of God in Jesus Christ. First of all, that means that the Lutheran school is grounded upon the love that God has displayed for mankind in Jesus Christ. And I know that that sounds passé or obvious, and that's sort of the problem if it sounds passé or obvious to us, or if we just sort of assume that, right? So why would I go to the length of building a building and then paying for it and making sure that we have teachers adequately instructed in order to all of them convey these things to the children? Why would I do that, first of all? It's because I hear things like what we heard in church this morning, right? I hear that God doesn't stand far off from us, right? He doesn't sort of observe us from a distance and hope that things work out, as parents sometimes do when their children are sent off to this or that educational institution. I hope it works out. Someone else is going to teach them, and I hope that it works out. He doesn't stand far away from us, right? He draws very near to us, right? So he becomes so near to us that he becomes one of us so that he can be with us both in his earthly ministry and then in the sacraments, most of all, the sacrament of the altar, so that he can, he says, be with us always, even to the end of the age. So there's this dwelling that God desires to have with man that indicates that I cannot, therefore, when I look at someone in Jesus Christ, I can't stand far off and say, well, I hope it works out. Especially with a question like education, which is so central to who the person becomes, not just in his, the way he makes money, his, or if we want to say it less crassly, maybe his calling, but who he is, how his soul is shaped or misshapen by what he learns. So it's this love of God that draws near to us in Jesus Christ that then is the ground for the love that both the parents and the congregation have for the child. So there's kind of two sources of where the school comes from. Okay, and this is an interesting thing, and this actually we'll get into if you want to talk about the rather convoluted history of Lutheran teachers and calls and the definition of the ministry. We can do that today. I'm not sure it's entirely germane, okay, but I'm happy to do it. It's interesting to me. I just don't think it's the most absolutely important thing to be discussed today. But this is Lindemann says the Lutheran school has two sources. One is a natural source. That is, any parent should care about what his child learns, right? Lindemann doesn't, because it's really pretty historically rare in American education until the 20th century. Lindemann says, I guess you could have children taught at home, but that's really the preserve of the wealthy. Partly because the home is a place of so much work, I mean physical work, that it's really not imaginable to anybody in the 19th century that mom is going to teach, or even dad is going to teach, any amount of school at home. That's just not really envisioned, except for the wealthy. So when Lindemann does mention what we would call homeschooling, he mentions it as maybe you could hire a teacher and he could be brought into the home. Okay, and with the just an absolute explosion in homeschooling since 2020, there are things like that beginning to happen. Okay, but again, that is still generally the preserve of the wealthy. Right, your average person is simply working too much to wash and clean and bake and cook. She's not going to be like, okay, let's do algebra now. right, that's simply not happening. So there's just kind of hard limits on that. So the vision here is that generally there's going to be a school. He says, therefore, we do not despise the public schools, right? So there isn't really an antagonism. There's simply the recognition that the natural motive to see your child trained is not enough for a Lutheran school to exist. On the parent's part, there has to be in him the knowledge of Jesus Christ, that he would say, that he would think to himself, this is the most important thing my child could possibly learn. Therefore, I need an education that is centered on that, right? So the parent has to have this kind of holy dissatisfaction with a purely natural reason for educating his child. He must care most about his child's obtaining heaven through the knowledge of Jesus Christ. That's the basic ground for the parent to want a Lutheran schooling. Okay. So he says, in that sense, that would be enough, right? And the parents of the congregation, just the people with school-age children, could get together and say, we're going to have a school on that basis. But he says, that would be a neglect, and in this sense, and Lindemann, who is both a school teacher and an ordained minister, okay, which is going to be generally the case for the presidents of, you know, what becomes Concordia Chicago, both teaching experience with ordination. So he's done both. So he says on the pastor's part, it would be very, very strange if he could look at any child who needs to be educated and say, you know, I hope that works out. And he continually refers to this admonition that Jesus gives to Peter after his resurrection, feed my lambs. So he sees that as given directly to the ministers, okay, with Peter as sort of their representative in this case, feed my lambs. And if the pastor can look with indifference at the children and say, it's okay, you can just go wherever or go somewhere that you're going to learn business skills but nothing about Christ, then he is neglecting his office. Okay, so he sees the school as an outgrowth of, in this sense, two loves. One is the Christian parent's love. One is the Christian pastor's love with the duties that come with love. Okay. So out of those loves flow obvious duties. Well, now I have to do something about this. This is why when he's thinking about why a school exists or who's in charge of a school, he says the school does not belong to synod. That's kind of an obvious Missouri Synod talking point, right? We don't have to listen to Synod, right? I say that with, you know, whoever's watching and with Pastor Paul in the room, you know, but we all know this is true, right? It doesn't belong to Synod. But also, the school is not the preserve only of those with children in it, because even if I don't have any children or my children are grown up and long gone from my home, I still, as a Christian, love the children who are in the congregation and want them to know Jesus Christ. So that the school's existence is not because somebody particularly wanted it. It's because of understanding the love of Jesus Christ. I would have the children know Jesus Christ above all things. That's why. So it's the entire congregation's concern. It's not just the concern, although it is obviously of parents or pastors or teachers. So he's going to see the teacher as working alongside the pastor, right? Because part of what the teacher is doing is helping the pastor fulfill his ministry. Okay? And he's going to see the teacher as working alongside the parents, helping the parents fulfill their duties of love to the children. Okay. Does that make sense? You have any questions or thoughts so far? Anybody? Everybody's good? Yeah, go ahead.
You said the school has...
...or specifically Christian.
Okay.
Yeah. And those are those duties of love that we okay. discussed. Yep. Anything else so far? So that's going to be the ground, the foundation, the basis, the fundament for why there are Lutheran schools. And when you think about it that way, and you think about the fact that this man is training at that time in his lifetime, basically all of your trained teachers in the synod, then you understand how and why the Missouri Synod is so unusual in the density of Lutheran schools, meaning there are Lutheran schools in other Lutheran church bodies. They're just far rarer, far rarer. Okay. And some of that has to do with culture. You know, the Germans have a much stronger sense of passing on their own culture than even Norwegians that we are in full communion with who train at the same seminaries. So that's different. But part of it is also a theological motivation that the Missouri Synod has more schools than the Wisconsin Synod, right? Which now sounds maybe a little paradoxical because they are definitely more insular than we are at this point. And we're not even necessarily insular. We spread throughout pretty much any major city in the United States. We have churches. We have, at one time, a teacher training institution in New Orleans, which very few people remember ever existed. So it's not really a question of staying put, necessarily, or of what is traditional, because this is really the first generation of our schools. It is the sense that if there is a church, there is at least one school. Now, I learned yesterday that your congregation has a history similar to many congregations, where there was really the school board of the congregation would have been more like a school district board because the church would start multiple schools. Okay, now this is the closest that we get to an idea that I find all over the place now when Lutherans talk about education, which is that somehow the Lutheran school relates to the extension of the kingdom of God. That's kind of the old word extension, what we would now call church planting, right? So Lutheran Church Extension Fund is kind of an old planting word. That's extension used to be used for that. And I hear often that Lutheran schools can be missionary agencies. That is, we bring the kids in and then they are taught. This is also one of the defenses of the Concordia system, that they're going to be brought to a Lutheran university or a Lutheran elementary school or a Lutheran high school, and there they will learn the truth of God. I'd have to say this is not exactly how this works early on. The way that this works early on is that the missionary work of the church is assumed to be going on. You'll notice this if you look at really boring things like old convention reports. Okay, very boring. Okay, so I'm just going to summarize it for you so you don't have to be the sad display of humanity that I am. That is, you'll notice that there are lists, right? So the list will always be congregations, pastors. The number of pastors is pretty much always, because we're doing the right thing, fewer than the number of congregations, not because we're shrinking, but because we're growing. Okay. And then you'll have a list of schools. And generally, especially in the Midwest, the number of schools will track with or even exceed the number of congregations. How does this work? It's assumed that part of the pastor's job is to find people and then to gather them into groups. Those groups could be, first of all, some kind of church, or they could be, first of all, some kind of school. And you say, well, they were all Germans. Well, you still had to do work. It's not as if the farmer was sitting there plowing his, you know, he's sitting there and he just got done plowing and he thinks to himself, I want my children to read Virgil in Latin, right? Or he thinks to himself, I really wish that somebody with a university education, like a Missouri Synod pastor, could teach my kid how to read and write. All organizing people into coherent groups where they're going to learn about Jesus Christ, whether during the weekday in a school or on Sundays in the church, it all takes work. Did they understand their target audience? Was people of relatively recent immigration in a certain language? Sure they did. But if you just think about it in that basic way, oh, people that know the same language and sort of live in the area, we have the same opportunity and we actually have more because we're not limited in belonging to a particular immigrant community at this point. All of that takes work to organize those people and to say, you need to bring your children. Okay. So we want to look at love as not only the ground, the love of God in Jesus Christ, but also the motive, the thing pushing us to have Lutheran schools and to keep them up and to extend them. That is to have more of them. So they are a missionary agency, but not in the sense that we say, we'll take your tuition dollars or we'll take the state's voucher dollars, and that will help us, and hopefully in exchange, you learn Jesus Christ. It's a whole package. That is, if you're going to be in the school, then you will be a member of the Lutheran Church either now or later, and your family will be. This is an all-encompassing life. That's why the school is there. That's why we pay for the school. That's why we have the teacher and the teacherage and all this other stuff that would look to other denominations or most Americans involved in American public schools like duplication of effort or much extra cost or something. Why do we have these things? It's out of love. That's what's going to push us to say, okay, we have one congregation here. Let's get another one over here. We have one school here. Let's get another one in the village, right? It's not only grounding us. Why do we do this? The love of God in Jesus Christ. But it's also pushing us outward. Right? And you will notice something if you are unfortunate enough to look at these old reports that the Missouri Synod, with its schools, the schools not lagging, right, the way they do today, where it's like we have, I don't know how many thousand congregations and how many schools do we have? Okay, and we don't really, it would be helpful to measure homeschoolers, but still, I don't think that would end up with a number where the homeschoolers plus the Lutheran schools would equal the number of congregations, or that the homeschoolers plus the Lutheran schoolers would cover, you know, an enormous percentage of most of our congregations, right? So how many people are getting a Lutheran education? There's a big lag today. For them, there's no lag. Why? Think about what we said earlier with the notion of this coming out of Feed My Lambs. The school is a holistic part of the church doing its job. It's a holistic part of the Christian parent doing his job to raise his children in the fear and admonition of the Lord. And it's a holistic part of the congregation with its pastor doing their job to care for the souls of those under their charge. So it's not really separate. It's also not really, therefore, optional. Right? So it's presumed that if you're a member of a Missouri Synod congregation, there is a school for you to send your children to, and your children do go to that school. I think that this sounds, so I'll just throw the boogeyman word out there and then we'll discuss why this is not the case. The word legalism, and I understand that and I get how that can occur. Look at the Pharisees as a display of the source and then also the fruits of legalism, if we mean anything really actually concrete by that word. Here's why I don't think that the way that we handled Lutheran schools was legalistic. One is that the basis for our action was not control over people. Think about how the Pharisees behave. They don't really do the things that they ask other people to do, but they do ask other people to do lots of things, right? You bind burdens you yourselves know are too heavy to bear, right? That's what the Pharisees do. And so they always have to, that's how they wind up pretending to be something they're not. Right? Because their teaching and what they actually do doesn't line up. They also are not teaching God's word. They are teaching what Jesus calls, right, traditions of men. Traditions of men. Treating it as if it is the doctrine of God. Okay? And this is really, I think, a caricature about our own history that we were like this. If you can read Lindemann, you get a hold of this book and you can read it, and I would love for somebody to translate it. He is a very lively, engaging person. And he talks a lot about, for instance, the need for the teacher to be lively and what we would call engaging, and he says friendly, right? So it's not this sort of caricature of forbidding and you will do what we say. And this is the way that we will handle people, and they will do exactly what we say, and then they will grow up and they'll give money to the church, right? It's not the same system of command, control, obedience, and then hypocrisy that you get with the Pharisees. So I do not think it is legalism. I think it is something else that is clear from the New Testament, which is that there are always, in every congregation, practical expectations for membership, okay, that people need to abide by. Let me give you a New Testament example, and then we'll kind of spell this out with Lutheran schools. New Testament example is that a rumor goes around in Thessalonica that people are not working because they're saying that the resurrection has already occurred. You know this. This is in 2 Thessalonians that this gets going. And they already have problems with this in 1 Thessalonians, right? Shocker, right? Congregations will have roughly the same problem for years and years, even when it's been dealt with, and they'll have to work through it, and it'll take time and so on. So however far apart 1 and 2 Thessalonians are, they're still confused about the resurrection. So by 2 Thessalonians, there are grown men who refuse to work. And, you know, Paul will say things that, again, sound harsh. We'll talk about the role of discipline in the next hour. But he says, let he who does not work shall not eat. Okay? Why? Because he needs to understand the consequences of not living up to the fact that we're all sacrificing for each other. We are, in words from a different epistle, we are bearing one another's burdens. Okay? So if we have, let's say, in a sample congregation, let's say we have 12 families, right? And that's going to be the source of our school, right? Their children. Now let's just imagine two out of those 12 families don't go along with that. It's not that I'm saying that your child will definitely go to hell if he doesn't go to the Lutheran school. That's the caricature of this, right? What I'm saying is we're doing something together. You need to do that with us so that what we're doing and the fact that we're doing it and the burdens we bear because of it will actually be done together as a congregation, as the subset of the congregation that have children in the school. Because once one of us starts to opt out from these practical life things, then all of us will think, well, it's just optional, I'll do whatever I want. And now we're really living our lives, Monday through Saturday, apart from each other. Practically, very practically, we are apart from each other. And I guess we can carry on that way for a certain amount of time, but eventually our school will obviously close because our lives are not really centered on the parish. On the church and its school. Our school will obviously close. And at that point, now it's so much harder to provide for what I know I need to provide for my child to know, which we'll talk about, especially what was that when we talk about scope in the afternoon, right? So the practical understanding, and this, there are different cases, and this gets parsed out differently in different places. And the English district, of which for the next 2 months I'm still a member, never goes along with this, is never really that helpful about having Lutheran schools. In fact, if you look deeply at the history of many of our English district congregations, you'll find out that they were founded by often wealthier members who wanted their kids to go to the English-speaking school, the public school, so that they could integrate with the social class that the parents belonged to. Okay, it's not like this. I'm not saying like any of this ever worked perfectly. I'm saying they had reasons for doing the things that they were doing. And I think that they were not only understandable, but often more deeply Christian than the reasons that we had for abandoning these practices, right? That they were driven by a certain understanding of what they intended for their child, which was much deeper than something that, very interestingly, Lindemann, writing in 1872, mentions. He says, it is characteristic of our American youth, 1872. It is characteristic of our American youth to devote themselves too much to the obtaining of, quote, a good job. 1872. Now, if you go, and there are really kind of fun things that you can find on the internet. I did this in doing some of the stuff that Mr. Girth mentioned for the series we did on Brief History of Power about American education. We did two on public education, two on private generally, including homeschooling, and then two on Lutheran education. is that if you go and you try to take, say, like a high school admission exam, right? Because high school isn't normal in the 1870s, right? Most people end their education at eighth grade, right? And that's still common in some of our rural communities down to the 40s and the 50s, 1940s, 1950s. If you take a high school admission exam, so there's a high school from the Northeast, so really good, it's still a good high school, Central High School in Philadelphia, and you take their admission exam from, say, 1880, I mean, I don't know if I could pass it. I don't know if I could get in to the high school, right? So here's what they're expecting of kind of a 14-year-old boy. Here's some Latin, translate that. Do this complex math. This is kind of normal. So that's the quality of education sort of generally. You know, it's really pretty good. But at that same time, JCW Lindemann is saying, you know, people are too focused on getting a good job. They think that's why you're being educated. And I think that that basic understanding of education is always going to be, it's going to be really difficult to make this case, this case grounded and motivated by love for Lutheran schools, whether parish school, homeschool, whatever. It's going to be hard to make that case if people understand, maybe on a deep level, that maybe we're not addressing when we talk about it to them individually, or if we talk about education in a sermon or a presentation at a voters meeting or something. If they sort of, in their heart of hearts, believe that education is essentially vocational, then the case for schooling, even, let alone Lutheran schooling, let alone please make this sacrifice so that we can continue to have our parish school, it's never quite going to ring true to people. If they're assuming that education is basically vocational, that it's all ultimately a means to an end. So, for example, let's say that I really stress, there are some public schools like this, there are private schools that I know of, I really stress public speaking. Okay. Really, really stress it. There are ways to teach public speaking such that it's of benefit for the church. You say, okay, well, we're gonna teach public speaking. We have a pre-seminary requirement at both our seminaries that they have to know some public speaking before they get there. There's also ways to think about public speaking that it's just, why don't you learn public speaking so that you can maintain control over other people, right? Sort of a pure sophistry. That's what the sophists in the ancient world do, right? They'll teach you anything for money. And the reason they'll do that is because they look at what they're teaching you, not as something that is changing your soul. It's just a series of techniques that you need to learn so that you can make more money or have more power than you did before you learned them. So this is an ancient problem. It's not new. It's not even new in America, right? So if you think people might be, maybe they're shallow, or maybe they don't really think very much about why their children are going to school or what they're learning in school, I'm not sure it's not a new problem. It's not even a very new problem because Lindemann is complaining about it all the way back then. Another thing to just sort of note about, you know, difficulties, right? So one difficulty in opposition to love would be, well, I thought education was just to get a job. Another difficulty in opposition to love is the rise in complexity of education. So this is my observation. This is neither Lindemann nor Kaler's. Because even Kaler, writing in 1930, Christian Pedagogy, predates the kind of consolidation, especially in rural areas, even of public education, that makes things like homeschooling or one-room schooling legally very difficult, depending on where you are. So what happens is that you get a sharp rise in the complexity of what it takes to have a school. A similar rise in complexity for having a pastor would be the cost of insurance or housing, right? Rising over that time, making it more and more difficult for congregations to have them. This happens first to schools, right? Because unfortunately, it seems, this is my observation, I'm happy to be corrected on this, but it's my observation that when a congregation is faced with, especially a cost challenge, the first thing to go is the Monday through Saturday Christian stuff that will be sacrificed in order to retain, and this makes basic sense, but it's sad nonetheless, in order to retain the functioning of the Sunday things. So your average congregant is not going to see the pastor much. He'll certainly see him on Sundays. We have to keep that. That makes basic sense. That is the heart and soul of the congregation's existence, is divine service. Unfortunately, people don't therefore make the connection between what happens then and then what happens in the school Monday through Friday. So because they don't see Sunday flowing into the rest of the week, when there is some kind of sacrifice that might need to happen, some kind of hardship that might have to be endured or borne, the stuff Monday through Friday is the first stuff to go, generally speaking. So, you know, there are plenty of congregations. Certainly, I've been to a number of them in the rural Midwest where there's this enormous building. And why is there this enormous building for a congregation of 40 people? It's because 40 years ago, they had a school, right? That they haven't knocked down for whatever reason, right? So the thing there is not that there are no more children, right? The number might be smaller in that parish, certainly, but that what has really happened is that Monday through Friday are now left up to very different agents of education, of information, of shaping, of the crafting of the children's souls, left up to very different agents than they were 40 years ago when they were still in school. Right, so we've got kind of this vocational focus on education that makes love hard for people to understand. Why would you do this? Why would you sacrifice? Why would you have these expectations for members? There's also the disconnect between what occurs on Sunday, what Sunday is a foretaste, how that is a foretaste of heaven, how that is the goal of the congregation gathered around the altar on Sunday. There's a disconnect between what's happening then and there and what is happening Monday through Friday, especially for the lambs.
Could you, you explain what you mean by vocation? Are you specifically looking at getting a job, that type of thing?
Yeah.
Or vocation rather than being,
yeah.
I am a father and that is
right.
Vocation, that's my station. Making a distinction?
Yeah, vocational in the sense that we use it like in education.
Okay.
So, you know, vocational technical school, right? Because I think the only way that you can think that's really what education is for is if you neglect vocation in the sense that we usually talk about it in the Lutheran Church, which is my goal in life is not to have a certain, you know, amount on my W-2 by the time I retire. Right? It's to be a father, it's to be a mother, it's right. Those are things that God has given me independent of my income, independent of my degrees, independent of whatever it is that I use to make money. And those are actually also going to be of much more lasting value and worth. My vocations, right? The fact that I am a member of a congregation, these kinds of, the way that I think about this, both for what schools do, but also I say this to congregants, I say this to students at the seminary, is you really need, if you want to understand what it is that you're supposed to be doing in life, think about the things that people do or don't ask for on their deathbed. And no one ever asks to be surrounded or mourns the fact that he is not surrounded by his impressive, you know, income statements, by the performance of his 401k in a certain decade, or a lot of the other things that people spend a lot of time and also education trying to obtain, right? It's, I want to see my children. I want the pastor to come. It is extremely clarifying for what education is supposed to be, because what I'm really shaping finally is, what is the person actually aiming his life toward? And the one who has aimed his life toward the getting of money, especially, right? And so Luther has this kind of throwaway, I mean, it's sort of a throwaway remark. This is Luther's way, right? It's an insightful observation, you know, moving on. Insults the Pope, monks are bad. Another insightful observation, that's kind of his rhythm, right? Insightful observation in the Large Catechism is that Mammon is the most common god beside the true God, right? So he's the most common competitor to the true gods. That's why this, you know, going to school is just for getting a good job. That's why this isn't a new problem at all. But it's one of the saddest misunderstandings, because one kind of schooling is actually oriented toward helping you appreciate, even when you're 19 years old, to some degree, what you will still appreciate and love rightfully when you're 89 and dying. And another kind of schooling is setting you up to be very ambitious and energetic when you're 19, but you're going to realize it's worthless maybe by the time you're 29, let alone 89. Like, it doesn't matter. And you have the job, you have the money, and still your life is hollow. So this understanding of what we're oriented toward is, if that can be grasped, then it is much, much, much easier to ask people, either with their children or with their time or with their money or whatever else it is that they have, to give to the existence, the maintenance of the school. Right? If they haven't grasped that themselves, even if they do send their children to the school, it's much harder to ask of the parents, of the children, of the parish, because they're sort of thinking on some deeper level than their behavior, revealed by other behaviors they have. They're still sort of thinking that life is about, you know, the obtaining of stuff, that you're still going to be building units the day you die to put more stuff into, right? And there's something delusional about that that has to be uncovered now, right, before it's too late for that person, that family, that parish. Yeah, good question. Other questions while we have a little bit of time? Anybody? Yeah, go ahead.
I know you said that one of them sent us in 1872, mm-hmm. but it seems to me, I'm not strong to the history, but that there was family, that there was apprenticeships. The school wasn't there necessarily to prepare them for their future work, yeah, because they might follow the family farm or they might apprentice. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There was a huge paradigm shift somewhere, apparently starting back then, mm-hmm. where it really was, schooling was for their future, to provide their family.
Yeah, that's good.
Instead of just coming through and doing what their family had done before.
That's right, yeah. And you can see the germ of some of these things. It's not nearly as widespread as it is today, where the person is on his second graduate degree, deeper in debt, in order to get a certain kind of a job. There is not nearly as much. I mean, we're still going to have presidents, you know, who are high school dropouts for many years after 1872, because it doesn't matter. What you accomplish is your resume, not how many or whence your degrees come, right? So, so it is very different. And interestingly, in that world, which actually sort of values credentials less than ours does, specifically what we would now call classical schooling is much more commonly accepted, right? So it's not, they're not fighting, right? So if you say, oh, well, my kid learns Latin at school, let's be honest, I mean, my kids, we homeschool, my kids learn Latin too, but let's be honest, that's weird. Right, you know, it's weird. It's great, but it's weird, right? Because what's much more common now is a very different orientation in education. At this time when education is not nearly so career focused, I mean, I don't know how many tests I took in public school to find out what kind of career I was supposed to have, right? And we even had, you know, rural schools, so I guess we were good potential cannon fodder. We all had Army recruiters come in and give us the Army vocational aptitude battery. you know, and then you get calls from recruiters for the next decade type of thing, because, you know, because they're training us for a job, right? But in 1872, that's not nearly as common. It's not nearly as common, partly because most folks, you're right, are going to go into what their father does or what their mother does. And those options are fairly limited, but life is not so much about choices as it is for us. And if they don't do that, then it's just presumed an education means, here's this paragraph of Latin, translate it. Tell me something about Herodotus, you know, type of thing to get into high school, let alone college. So yeah, that's a very good point. Yep. Other questions or comments right now? We have a little bit of time. It's up to you guys. All right, so let me sum up a little bit and then set us up for the next hour. We'll take a 15-minute break and come back at 11:30 after this. So let me set us up for that. Is that in the next hour, when we talk about discipline, I do want to talk about that in the common sense that it has in English, which is the discipline of a classroom, or what, you know, classroom management, I guess, is kind of our more modern neutral term, but it's all the same stuff that they were talking about under the idea of discipline. But also in the sense that the English word discipline is related to another English word, disciple. And that what the school is there to do, right, what is love actually trying to carry out Monday through Friday, is to produce disciples of Jesus Christ. And that discipling, right, that discipline in and under Jesus Christ is going to have a certain shape. So we'll talk about what that shape is for, respectively, the classroom, right? What is this like? How are they thinking about this? How does the classroom need to be? Okay, and this is not, you know, not all of this is going to be entirely like, yes, this is exactly what we need to be doing. Like, let's go back. Like, let's get in our horse and buggies and run all our schools in exactly this way. But what were their classrooms like? Okay. In addition to that, what kind of discipline is supposed to be inculcated in the child? And there's going to be kind of a formula for how both Lindemann and Kaler talk about the child and his nature. And then finally, what kind of discipline is the teacher self-discipline, right? So what is the teacher working on in himself for Lindemann, or himself or herself for Kaler, that is going to be necessary to doing the job well, right? Not for being stagnant, right? Not for just kind of, okay, I've done this 27 times, I guess I'll do it a 28th time, you know, but continuing yourself also to grow, because the discipling is not just of the student, it's also, and you know this if you teach, and especially if you love teaching, it's also of the teacher. Yeah. You are changed in Jesus Christ as you teach, right? So we'll talk about that. That'll set us up for some of the more nitty-gritty stuff we'll do in the afternoon, which will be fun. How did they teach handwriting? Why did they teach handwriting? They had to teach two different kinds of cursive. Because German has a different kind of English. So just kind of fun stuff in the afternoon, but we'll do a little bit more heavy stuff. Take a 15-minute break, and then we'll come back.
The 8th Annual Men's Gathering is happening at Lakeview Villages in Seymour, Indiana, the weekend after Easter, April 21st through the 24th. Join other Christian men for a relaxing weekend of fellowship, feasting, and fun of every kind. Men will learn how to resist tyranny and how to have a good conscience as fathers, men of the church, and citizens from our main speaker, Dr. Kuntz. He'll guide everyone there through scripture and church history as we seek to live as free men.
Check out our website at www.mensgathering.us for more information and to register. You can also search Men's Gathering on Facebook for updates leading up to the event. It is going to be a wonderful weekend for men to relax in God's beautiful creation. The timely topic will be an encouragement and provide much needed strength as we go to battle against the powers of this world.
We hope you'll join us for the 2022 Men's Gathering, a proud supporter of A Brief History of Power.